Hey, everybody, Stu Smith here with another Two Through and After. Special guest, we have Vince, Rescue Swimmer Mindset, Coast Guard Rescue Swimmer. Love to chat a little bit about your journey, Vince. But first, welcome to the Two Through and After podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Stu. It's good to see you again.
Absolutely.
Making this a weekly routine now.
Yeah, I'm going to have you guys on this Two Through and After. Love to hear your story as well as Cody's story. I was recently on your podcast, which is called the Rescue Swimmer Mindset podcast.
That's right. That's right. Yep.
And that's his website, Rescue Swimmer Mindset. But before we get into what you are doing now, let's talk about the journey that has taken place to get you to where you are today. So first question, who were you before you joined the Coast Guard?
That's a question I've certainly reflected on quite a bit, just discussing kind of who I was before. And I can only describe myself arguably as a punk, and at least in those high school days, right? Like, I feel like me and the director had, or like the principal in French, we call, I'm actually from Montreal, Canada. Oh. Yeah, and so in French, it's your directeur, you call him, right? So me and the principal, we were just on a very, very close basis, because I feel like I was just in there on a weekly to bi-weekly basis, you know, just always kind of that troublemaker child. I think eventually I developed into wanting to have more discipline in my life, but not just discipline, but actually more than anything, go after a pursuit that I thought I could potentially not succeed at.
Okay.
Which
how about sports? Was that something that brought you into a little more discipline, a little more use of your energy versus being in trouble at school? You spent it doing sports. What was your outlet?
Yeah, well, one thing we talked about this a little bit on our podcast, but I started working out at a very young age, as in like weightlifting. And young age, in my opinion, I mean, like for me, it was, I think, 12 years old or 13 years old.
Same.
And yeah, never stopped since, really. I mean, you know, you have like those lulls in your life where you're traveling and you're away for a month and it's just harder, but you're still doing calisthenics. You're doing something. For me, it was that weightlifting that I started at 13 years old. I never did too many of the team sports. I remember, yeah, as far as like the football thing, I actually got accepted to be the quarterback in that freshman year. For us, it's in Quebec and Montreal there. It's, I guess your seventh grade is like when you start high school. And I was just such a scrawny little fella. I have a photo of me and the pads, and it looks like these pads are just eating me up alive. I don't belong in these pads. And I recall somehow making the team. I guess I could throw or something, but in like the first, I guess, or what do you call these? Like your trials, just your when you're working out or you're prepping, the starter quarterback, who's also a scrawny guy, tall, he's a senior, is just calls for the ball, and he just goes back to clear the line, and I happened to be in the wrong, I shouldn't have been standing there. I don't know what I was doing, but I was standing behind him, and just the quarterback backing up sent me flying about like 10 yards. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to survive, and my knees are going to make it through one season of this until I've like grown up to be not like this twig. And I was like, coach, I got to walk on this. I don't think this is a good call for my body right now.
That was probably pretty wise. I didn't start playing football until ninth grade, but I had been lifting for a couple of years before that. You know, back where I grew up, it was very similar as far as, you know, people starting to work out early. My question for you was, what was it that got you into the gym? Was there a particular exercise or what was it that was the big motivation for you?
Man, that's probably a combination of factors. One being a little self-conscious, being very skinny. I think I have that natural ectomorph body type, so I need to eat a lot to put on that weight. So it's not a natural thing for me. I think I was a little sick of being that scrawny, you know, fella. And then my father worked out as well. So I think I, you know, always seeing my father lifting, being fairly, you know, I mean, in good shape. There's something to that. I mean, when you're a child, you know, you're looking up to your leadership, whatever that is. And sure. that was certainly in my life. And then I think I had to like really beg my father, like, can you teach me the ways of the Force? And then he was like, nah, you're not ready. And I was like, all right, I'll start alone. And then I started alone. And he's like, all right, well, he seems like he's got a little dedication. So I'll teach him a thing or two, you know?
Nice. That's cool. I enjoyed working out with my son as he was in that same age group. And, you know, we had discussed a little bit on your podcast as well, that process. But how about this? When was it that you decided, all right, I'm going to join the Coast Guard and go after this rescue swimmer job?
So
did they occur at the same time, or was it within you've learned about it?
Yeah, it was kind of an evolution. I was a tree planter, which is a very, I'd say, blue collar, young position to do as a Canadian. It's kind of like, if you want to get after it, make a good amount of bucks at a young age, but you have like the dedication to just put in physical work, you go tree planting. And that's tends to be out west. I mean, they have it throughout Canada. You're basically replanting the Queensland, as they say, right? Because the loggers come in, they cut it, and your job is to replant. Anyway, I was out there, and somebody that actually held, you know, that was like important to me at the time, got severely, like there's an incident and they needed to get evacuated but via helicopter. So search and rescue comes, and who came is, and we've had these individuals on our podcast, is a SARTEC, they call them, a search and rescue technician in Canada. Insane individuals. They're kind of like the Air Force PJs of Canada. So, you know, I was completely unqualified. I think I was like 19 years old. I didn't know what to do in that situation. And this guy came in like our savior, like our God in the sky that just came in. I remember thinking, wow, I wish I was as qualified or as educated on how to help someone as this person. And I just thought that was such a cool position. So I looked into that, and but what I was seeing is not that like I wasn't okay with the process, but one stage of the process I didn't like with that was it seemed like you had to just join like the army and pretty much go infantry for not necessarily infantry, but more than likely, and do that for like 2 years, and then you apply, and then you gotta potentially like do your paramedic license and all that. And I was willing to do that, and that's certainly something like I was looking in that process. But then I got a level with you. Like, it was right around then that I saw the movie The Guardian.
Yes.
With Kevin Costner and Ashton Kutcher.
Great movie.
Yeah. And that was the same thing. I was like, this is the best movie ever. Who the hell are these guys? This is like the American version of these SARTECs. And I started doing my research, my investigating into that position. And yeah, I really just liked everything that surrounded that job. Seemed like they had a little bit more search and rescue cases. It seemed like you had more opportunity to travel throughout. You know, America's got a little more diversity. You got Puerto Rico as a station. You got Hawaii. You got Alaska. Versus Canada, you got, it's going to be cold. You're going to be up there, and you're going to be cold. So I really like that. And I also understood that the process, if you're disciplined and if you're dedicated to that undertaking, you can get it done. At least when I was going in, within the span of a year, you could potentially be an active rescue swimmer. And that's what I did.
Nice. I remember watching The Guardian. That was a great movie. And you know you're going for a cool job when they make movies about it, yeah. Right? And, you know, The Guardian was one of those great ones. One great actors in it. And I remember seeing it on DVD back then. Right. And you know, I'm dating myself a little bit. But I noticed that there's an alternate ending in that. Yeah, did you notice that?
I sure did.
I was completely shocked that there was an alternate ending on that DVD. And it was such a better ending, too.
The alternate, you preferred the alternate?
I did. Where he lived.
Oh, was you're that? A sap for a happy ending.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I enjoyed the I mean, both of them were really cool. Both endings were cool, but I thought it was a neat touch to add that alternate ending in there.
I don't know. To me, it came off like it was certainly interesting. It was like a little corny because, okay, so we'll just tell the alternate ending is this guy, like, watch the movie, but then in the end of the alternate ending, they both make it into the helicopter, and Ashton Kutcher, who's like one of the main characters, goes, "Well, you didn't see that in the manual." You're just like, oh my God.
Yeah. There's always corny comments. It doesn't matter. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about that transition for you. You're planting trees, and then you're going to now start this process and learning to swim. Now, I'm assuming you have dual citizenship in Canada. And
that's right. You
know, that was able to go through that process smoothly.
Right. They call me a Camerican. yeah. A mix.
Yeah.
I'm a hybrid. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I like it. So how did that work whenever you were realizing, okay, I got to do a lot of swimming now? How was that process for you?
Yeah. So I had to basically learn how to swim. And, you know, it's funny, you go to the recruiter, and I think it's still very likely that this is the process, but you go into the recruiter, and at least the Coast Guard recruiters, and you say, they're like, what do you want to do? And you're like, I want to be a rescue swimmer. And then he goes, ugh.
Of course you do. Everybody does. You do.
Yeah. And he's like, all right, what's your backup? I remember that's like immediately his question. What's your backup? And I was like, and it seemed like this is like in my application process. So I'm like, it seems like he actually wants me to have a backup. And I remember just having to wing it. I was like, who's the guy that drives the boat? I'll do that. So I didn't have a backup. A lot of guys that go rescue swimmer out, they'll tell you they don't have a backup. I can't say I really thought of that as an option, but you know, I remember saying that.
It's nice to not have to rely on a plan B.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like, you got to get this done.
Right? Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So as far as, getting prepared for swimming. No, let's be real. I was always in the water. I'd say I had that overall water confidence. I think my mother would say, she would always come in like the bathroom, and she thought like I was dead in the tub because I was just like holding my breath in there. Right. One of those like classic, you know, I had that water base, the confidence, but I did not have any technique whatsoever. So what I decided to do to get myself prepared in that transition of that recruitment process was to join. And I recommend anybody kind of doing this because it really changed my game. And I joined what they call like masters teams.
Yep,
and that tends to be in every community. So mine was in Montreal, but they have them in America. Joined the masters teams, and it's just, I think 18 to, in my organization, up to like mid to late 60s.
Oh yeah. It's like intramural swimming for anybody.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I recall, you know, I was in shape at this point, and I recall showing up, and the instructor, the coach, goes, all right, why don't you start in this lane? And he points to, which clearly the slowest lane, the most on the right, with, and no offense, but like people that seemed out of shape and past the age of 60. So, and I was like, well, that's just not fitting to who I am. And he's like, well, why don't you just start there and then you'll progress. And then I was like, all right, I'll crush this out of the water. I remember getting in that pool, and these like elder, like, I mean, there's people in the, I think actually in the 70s, like these elder grannies just crushing me in the water. I was like, I was struggling to be 10 to 20 yards behind them. And they were like, some were lapping me in this slow lane. So it just goes to show. And I was like, wow, I don't know if this whole dream of becoming a helicopter rescue swimmer is very reasonable. But, you know, showing up at that 6 a.m. call, kept doing it. And soon I graduated from that slow lane onto the middle slow lane and so on into the average until, I think within 6 to 7 months, I was in the fast lane with those people that were prior athletic swimmers and some that were still competing in like these Ironmans and everything like that. And the goal was always to catch up or to work my way to the next person that's better than me in that lane, right? So I would progress, and then I would graduate to that next person, and then that's the person I was swimming with or behind. And then eventually I would really analyze, okay, am I ready to graduate to the next person? And yes, I would be. And I would make that leap. I'd recommend that too. And I think that's something you said, Stu, is you said compete to win.
Oh yeah.
Not to
yeah.
survive.
Train to compete. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You got to train to compete. You know, I tell people that all the time about, you know, being patient with the process, because I can't tell you, and I'm sure you have seen this countless times yourself, how many unprepared people join these jobs, you know, that require a significant amount of preparation and training. Like you just spent several months just to get into a fast lane, you know, and be able to now swim 500 yards without stopping, right? And do it at a, you know, competitive level, so to speak. And now you're a much better student to go do what you're going to do. And a lot of people don't have that patience, or they don't understand the level of physicality that's about to be involved.
Mm. It just often comes down to your ego. You want to say in like weightlifting, right? You just want to lift that weight versus taking the time to perfect the form. We had another Navy SEAL who was telling us just now in his retired years has learned to focus so much on the movement and just really wrap your mind around how you're performing, say the squat, and like just could, like really thinking about every muscle that's stabilizing, that's moving, how your positioning is, well under your weight. And apparently you can have, like, without ever actually even progressing in that weight, you can have comparable improvements just by doing that, keeping your mind focused on that movement. And for swimming, it's more than anything, it's a technique sport. I mean, like, I've seen people that look tremendously out of shape that could swim laps around me. You know, it's not per se your physical, it's like, it's how much you've dissected that technique. And I know absolutely. That's what you teach.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of technique, and it's conditioning too. And some people who maybe don't have the greatest technique have to rely on better conditioning. And it's a little bit of this give and take back and forth. And eventually you're going to have a really good conditioning and the technique clicks for you. When for you did you have, you felt like, okay, it just clicked, I'm ready to go?
Never. I don't think I ever thought I was fully prepared, which could potentially be a good thing. But I always, even when I was going to the airman program, so airman program for rescue swimmers at the time was a 4 to 5 month process before they sent you to the 4 month school. And even going to that, I remember thinking, oh, I'm not ready. Yet it seemed like I performed really well from the feedback I got from those rescue swimmers. But I think at all points here's my problem. I think in one of my first days of that airman program, I recall just getting worked. They did this thing called the Mountain Goat Mile. This is after we did these pole sprints. You know, if you've ever done those, you know, you use a pole, you speed up and you hold a sprint to the next pole and then you slow it down at a jog and then keep doing that. Then we did some beach PT. And then these night shift rescue swimmers showed up and they're like, oh, you the new airman? Oh, cool. Let's go work out. I was like, I just got wrecked. Like, I can't do this. And then they made me go through this circuit of doom. And I remember thinking, I think the problem was one of the rescue swimmers says, this is what it's going to be like every day of rescue swimmer school. And I remember thinking, okay, so there's no way I'm going to do this. And I remember them saying that throughout my airman program on those rough days. But what was interesting is very rarely, if ever, were the days as tough in our rescue swimmer school, which I guess would be like your buds and
right.
Like even our hell week, I don't feel like it ever compared to some of those worst days. So I remember always thinking in the school, oh my God, when's it going to kick in to being like those days every day? And it never came.
Well, that's good. That's good preparation if you can do that. Cause I mean, whew, Some of those days can be really challenging. So if you will, let's kind of back it up a little bit and let's start with Coast Guard boot camp. Right. Let's talk through that and we'll just kind of go through the pipeline, if you will. Just kind of walk us through the pipeline of you've joined and now you've just shipped off. What was that transition like for you?
So, yeah, you do the whole boot camp thing. I think I always would say the boot camp was in some way more challenging for me than rescue swimmer school. And I just think that's like, it comes down to the sleep deprivation and it's just exhausting. You're just wrecked, like physically or not physically, but more like mentally wrecked. And I remember the PT in boot camp being, they just do it until nobody can do it. Right. Like at least that's what they were doing for us. They were just doing like push-ups until nobody's doing push-ups anymore. And then they yell at you for the fact that you're not doing push-ups anymore. And just that for every PT. And I remember just my body not feeling like this is smart per se conditioning at the time. Versus in swimmer school, I feel like they were a little bit more disciplined and smart about the training and the evolution. You would put in more effort and like more hard things, but it wasn't as like stupid working out, if you will.
Did you feel like you got out of shape at boot camp compared to what you were doing before?
That's a good question. A lot of people would say that. I know the food wasn't great, you know, so I wouldn't say like I came out of boot camp looking fat or anything or excessively skinny. Maybe I was a little skinnier because I wasn't weightlifting and stuff like that. I would say, overall, because my training and conditioning was a smarter cycle and more disciplined routine, including smart rests.
Yes.
Versus boot camp, there's none of that really. There's no sleep, so there's not much rest. And I got a little out of shape.
It's pretty common, especially with Coast Guard and Navy, you know, for guys that are trying to go into the next job, diving, SEAL, SWIC, EOD, you know, those type of jobs, rescue swimmer. It's a deconditioning event, which is boot camp. That's why they've created all these prep schools now to kind of build them back up so they can prepare to go to, the next selection process. Was there something like that for you when you got out, or was that just did you go to airman training right after that and they just kind of added it to for you?
No, for us, after, at least at the time, now there's a system like that in place. But for me, it was then you go out to the fleet. So, and my request, you put in like a request sheet, and whether you get it or not, it's whether up to the detailer or up to the detailer. Yeah. And I said, send me far away, like as far away as possible, like to one of these remote islands. And I originally got Guam and I was super psyched. And then it turned out I was going to Hawaii, which is also great. So, yeah. So then you do that. And I was stationed on one of these, what's one of our biggest boats, but probably a little skiff for the Navy, but a 378 foot boat. And that was, ported in Hawaii, but we would go to Japan, Alaska, all these different places. And yeah, I'm just, for that period of time, I'm cleaning dishes, I'm painting decks, I did some cool things though too, like boarding team officer. I did, I feel like I did something else that was cool. It's kind of forgetting it now, but yeah, you're doing like kind of the basic seamanship thing, bottom of the totem pole. And the harder you work at getting qualified in, say, like firefighting, and these like qualifications that you need to do. And once you're ready, or once you've knocked them all out, then, and you serve your minimum time, which is 6 months, then you're technically eligible to be sent to the process of becoming the rate that you want to have, which in my case is an AST, right? An aviation survival technician is what rescue swimmer, the rate is. The rescue swimmers are, that's like a collateral, right? To that job. And yeah, so I knocked it out. I worked my butt off and knocked it out as quickly as I could. And I remember going to the chief on the boat to check out, right? And he goes, who are you again? And I go, I'm Vince. And he goes, when'd you get here? I was like, 6 months ago. He's like, and you're leaving already? Because some guys are there like 3 years. He's like, you're leaving already? I was like, yeah. He's like, good for you. And I was like, See you later.
Nice. That's quick.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
And then that's when the airman program begins, and that's when you're getting trained.
And where do you go for that?
So typically at the time you would go to whatever nearest station is to your prior station. So my prior station was a boat in Hawaii, and there's a air station in Hawaii that's called Barbers Point.
Yeah.
Yep. So in Honolulu, or sorry, in Oahu, yep. South Shore there. And that's where it was. Great station, very small, quaint. They got HH-65s is the bird. So the small helicopters, those French ones that we talked about. And then the Jayhawks, or no, sorry, not the Jayhawks, the larger planes, which are the Hercules or something.
Yeah. C-130.
Yeah. C-130. Yeah.
Yeah. Ah, man, that's pretty cool. So what did you do as an airman? That was just at first you were learning all the boat stuff. Now, are you learning all the helicopter airplane?
Not too much learning as far as like minimal, because that's when you are actually a rescue swimmer. That's when they actually put in the time to teach you how the plane operates, all the engines. Like Cody, when my partner in the rescue swimmer mindset, he just went back in the Coast Guard. He had to redo all that. So relearning the parts of the helicopter, becoming a basic air crewman and all that jazz. You learn a little bit of that in the airman program, but I remember doing a lot of things like helping the rescue swimmers out in packing these chutes. So for the drops out of the C-130s, I remember a lot of wrapping the lines. So like you wrap the lines that the chutes are attached to, and to the cargo that those attached to for their like practice drop flights. So, you know, you're wrapping these things up, packing chutes, sewing. That's something that rescue swimmers don't per se like to brag about, but that's like a technically a little collateral that we have to do is sewing. So patching certain survival equipment up, flight suits and stuff like that. So we do, you know, a joke is we're called like aviation survival technicians, but in, you know, behind closed doors, we're also aviation sewing technicians. So,
well, you know, it sounds like you're a little bit like in the Navy, it was the riggers, parachute yep. riggers, that job. Yep. Cause they do a lot of sewing and, you know, packing and, you know, packing chutes and all that stuff too, as well.
Yeah. The day to day of a aviation survival technician is actually maintaining the survival gear of the aircraft. That includes the inflatables if the helicopter goes down. So we're packing those and, you know, those come up for servicing on specific periods. So we got to inspect it in various ways. So we bust those open. Basically what the flight crew wears, their vests, all that survival equipment that they have, we're checking that. It all comes up for monthly or quarterly assessments or yearly. And that's what we're doing when we're not performing as in search and rescue missions.
Gotcha. In the Navy, we call that PMS, preventative okay. maintenance system.
Yep.
Exactly. Is similar, same in the Coast Guard?
Yes. Yep.
PMS, yeah. Yeah. All right. So now you shared a little bit about some of the hard workouts you were able to do going through this airman training. When was it that you made it finally to the Coast Guard Rescue Swimmer School?
Yeah, 5 months is the period of time. I remember, I think they came to me at like a 2 month period. And the rescue swimmers in Hawaii, they go, hey, there's a slot open in rescue swimmer school. Do you want to go? And again, in that same, that my mindset was never that I was really ready. And based on how I performed after the 5 month period, I don't know, there's a part of me thinks I probably would have made it as well if I had gone and taken that opportunity at the 2 month period. But a part of me was like, no, I'm going to want more time to train, to prepare. And make myself ready. I also had like an IT band issue. I think I was working out. I wanted to, because I knew that school was going to make me run a lot. And I was like, I want to make sure I got this like really corrected before going to the school. So 5 months is what it took before I went to the Rescue Swimmer School, which is in Elizabeth City, North Carolina.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Gotcha. So were you ready?
It seems like I was. Seems like I was. And yeah, I remember just like first day, I think they chose to make me the, what do they call him? Like the lead airman of the group for like the first week, because I think I was the youngest person there, if not the second youngest. So they put me there. And one funny thing is like, they, you know, when you start off, they're like, all right, get the airman onto the pool deck. And some of these people that are in the rescue swimmer school, they've gone through the school before, they've been there. So they know where, how it runs, how it operates. I'd never been there. This is my first time. And yeah, they're like, get him out on the pool deck. I was like, I don't even know where the pool is. And so I remember like looking to some other airmen, and they guide me. And I, my job is to like march the crew out, and they're all behind me. So like, and then there's like a whole routine of how you get in the pool, how you do everything, right? I don't know any of it because I'm brand new. And but this is like for the PT in test, which you have to do. Like one of the things you got to do is your 500 meter swim under 12 minutes or something. And I remember the rescue swimmers in Hawaii saying, don't, you know, you're strong, but don't per se show them that off the bat, like, you know, because then they're just gonna pick on you. So, but nevertheless, I remember getting in that pool, and since I was in the front as the lead, I was facing that right, you know, I turn right when I do my strokes, I face the right side of the pool. So I wasn't looking at anybody else in those, I don't know, 20 something rescue swimmers that showed up. And I thought I was going as slow as I could go. And I get to the other end and do my flip, and I'm like, I got like a pool, a half a pool length in front of everybody. And that's probably the adrenaline, right?
Yeah, sure.
But I was like, oh, I gone messed up. I gone messed up real bad. And I was like, well, now I can't make myself look slow, because then it totally looks like I'm milking it. Or maybe I was just an idiot swimmer. I just sprinted, but I didn't. So I kind of like, yeah, set myself up a little bit there. And yeah, I mean, as far as the swimmer goes, I was a pretty good swimmer from what I've come to hear in that program.
Nice. So what would be a piece of advice you give to somebody who shows up on day one of rescue swimmer school?
That's a tough one, because everyone tends to fail out that first day or two or three. And a lot of times it's those individuals that you're like, that's an athlete that's going to 100% make it. That there's no, like, I'm nothing. I don't know. It's hard to not play the comparison game, though I would certainly advise not to. But it's hard to not do that and look at these people, be like, oh man, I don't stand a chance compared to this guy. Yet that's the guy that often will walk. Sometimes not, but a lot of times it is. And yeah, I would say, yeah, try not to compare yourself. Try to just, you know, just take it. I mean, this is cliche, but take it one exercise at a time. And one thing I've shared, which I don't think is a per se good mindset, as things got tougher and the school progressed, a part of me was like, I think it'd be lying to say that I didn't think of quitting. I thought of quitting almost like every drill. And I would always be like, well, let me just, you know, it'd be awkward if I did it midway through this drill. So, you know, I don't want to be that guy and cause a scene. And I don't want to, it's embarrassing to everyone, including the instructors. I don't need to do this. I'll just do it after this drill. And then that drill would complete. And I was like, well, might as well see what's next. And then they would say, and I was like, ah, it's not that bad. I'll just do that. And then I'll quit on the next one. And then I'd finish that. And then the day would be done. And I'd be like, well, I'm not going to quit at the end of the day. I just look like an idiot. So I'll just do it first thing in the morning. And then the morning starts, and so on and so forth. So, you know, I'm not saying have that mentality, but definitely taking it one exercise at a time. And you got to be narrow-minded, because if you're thinking the long haul, you're like, dude, I can't do this for 4 months straight. This is terrible. This is torture. I can't, like, this is idiotic, right?
That's a long bit of training. How much would you say in those 4 months, percentage-wise, is swimming compared to out-of-the-water activities, PT, lifting, running?
I'd say, well, that's the thing, because like near the end part is, you know, there's definitely more learning, and because at that point you're kind of making it, and now they're like, all right, well, we need to teach you something. You're not just a swimmer. You need to learn aircraft things and how to perform in this job. So it's a little less pool time. But in the beginning, in the first half, I would say, you know, it's a good percentage, probably like 30, in between 30 to 40%, because you start off on our grinder. So we're doing our PT, we're doing like our calisthenics, our weightlift, kettlebells, runs. That tends to last around 2 hours. And then you go to the pool and that lasts, I would say, yeah, another three or something like that. And then you would have your lunch break, and then you would typically go back to the pool, which in that pool session, yeah, you could get worked, but also it was teaching you search and rescue things, how to control a combative or non-compliant survivor, how to, you know, use different techniques to get them either in a basket or in a litter, or how to get somebody out of a parachute, which is one of our big tests. So yeah, it's a good portion of water training for sure.
I would imagine
first half.
Yeah, I would imagine. Now, did you have any people in your class that, like on the swimming spectrum? I always look at the spectrum like this. You have people who go into a swimming pool and play Marco Polo, right? That's the bottom end of that little spectrum. You have guys that are like military level swimmers, and that's like buds included. And then you have competitive swimmers above the age of 12 years old can typically kick the butts of any of these below them. Right. Yeah, so,
that's right.
So you have the competitive swimmers, you have military swimmers, and you have people that are comfortable enough in the water to go underwater without panicking. Where in that spectrum was most of your class?
Most tends to be in that military operator class. They're not breaking records as far as, you know, non-gear or gear swims, but they're definitely proficient. And, you know, you look at them and you're like, that's a strong swimmer. But yeah, they probably wouldn't even make the high school team or whatever, or like, you know, whatever. There was one that was I believe a high school and college swimmer. He was the best for sure when it came to non-gear swimming. Yet he was not the fastest when it came to the gear, like putting the fins on. And that's what mostly we're doing as helicopter rescue swimmers. We got our Triton, so like our vest, we're rarely swimming without, you know, our wetsuit, our vest, our fins, our mask and snorkel. So, and now I think they make them wear the helmets in the pool, which sounds terrible.
Yeah, I will say that, you know, even in my buds class, there were people who were unable to swim very well without fins, right? Let's say a football player, you know, somebody with big legs, rugby player, football player type, barely getting through the minimum standard on the 500-yard swim to get into the training. But then 99% of all your swims are going to be with gear and with fins. And there might be a few other drills that you do without fins, but most of that will be with fins. And those guys were in the front of the pack all the time because they got these big old powerful legs that you put on big rocket fins and you're just plowing through the water, where, you know, some guys that might not have the big muscle legs have a hard transition into that. Did you find that your ankles and hips and knees took a long time to transition to getting used to those big fins?
It's a good question that goes into play of like working your way up and not having the ego and taking it slow, right? Because especially when we're working, I think do you guys use the same jet fins as us probably? Yeah.
I prefer the jet fins, but I think you can use jet or rocket.
Yeah, rocket's fins. A little stiffer even than the jet fins.
Yeah, much more pliable. Yeah, jet fins are.
When we are teaching, and that's what our company does too, when we're building people up into succeeding with these gear swims, we recommend you start with a smaller fin, something like a body surfing fin, because that's so demanding on your ankles at first, right? So you don't have those micro muscles that are going to adjust and stabilize. You're going to hurt yourself probably. So taking it slow with that for sure. Once at that point in school, as far as the ankles go, no, they're built up. So they're pretty fine. Though one thing that us rescue swimmers tended to have, and it's a problem, it's such a weird one. We get this like bump on top of the foot, right? It's like right on that I don't know which part of that foot that is, but where that the bone is like the highest. And you could see these rescue swimmers with like scars. Like when you graduate the school, it's kind of like a, you could tell who went through the school because they got these scars on the top of their feet. And we develop all these methods of preventing that. And the best way I found was a sneaky one where I realized, oh, you know what it is? I think I got too new of a fin because the fin pocket is a square. And I remember going to one of the instructors once who I was like close with, and I go, hey, you think you could get me in that gear room? He's like, what do you want? And I was like, I want a different fin. He's like, what's your problem? I was like, I just want a different fin. He's like, fine. I was like, I had to beg. And then I went in and I got an old jet fin, because what an old jet fin does is it's softer rubber. So it worked around my foot better. And that was like so much less, it was just more molded to my foot. And sure, maybe there's a little less power and it's a little flexier there, but I dealt with it. I learned it. But more than anything, it was preventing me from bleeding and like having such pain from that bump. Just like some people had to walk away because they literally couldn't push with the fit anymore, because it becomes like it builds up like a cyst almost, and then it breaks like a volcano, and then you got this pus thing. Yeah. It's gross.
Yeah, your foot does rub in those foot wells of the fins, and it's a painful process. You know, you really do have to toughen up your feet. Not very unlike the way if you're going in the Army and you're rucking a lot, you have to get your feet really tough for the miles of rucking as well. So yeah, foot care. Very good point. Okay, last question on rescue swimmer school for you. And then we'll talk a little bit about the job itself. What was one of your favorite or least favorite, just hardcore swim PT that you would have to do at rescue swimmer school? Because I know you guys are like the master of the swim PT, right? Mm-hmm. Swim a bunch of laps, carry people, rescue people, under overs, PT in on the pool deck. You know, all that stuff. What was just one that you really remember being, whoo, okay, that was a butt kicker?
Yeah, I'd say there's kind of two. I just want to share the ones, my physical one. I hate, what are those, like the turtles, where you just got to like, this is just not swimming. This is just like you're on your stomach and you got to do like the flying turtle.
Oh, the arm haulers.
We
call them arm haulers. Yes.
I think I got is that a lower back, Stu? Is that what that is?
Is it kind of like a horizontal jumping jack?
Exactly. But what is that working? Your like lumbar
muscles? Yeah, I would say it probably works a little bit of upper back, lower back combos, some shoulders.
I got to be honest. Like that was like, they didn't pull that out that much and it was just like survive that. But I hated that. I need to work on those muscles or something because I was not good at that. But anyway, as far as the swimming goes, I have one where I almost passed out, and that was because I came out of doing a test in front of like an audience. Cause like sometimes you have like these higher, like these generals or not generals, but admirals come in. And I remember they chose me to do a test, and of course they make it as dramatic as possible. And they really, you know, we're dealing with these combative non-compliant survivors. And so you're barely getting oxygen. You're kind of half drowning while you're doing all these pressure points on to control these people, get them in the basket. It's exhausting. And right after that, on the other side of the pool, they were doing these drills, but with the other candidates that were like just doing the drills, they were like fresh into doing just the drills. But I was coming out of like this wrecked thing. I think they just saw me as proficient. So they're like, fine, just get in the pool and just join in. But what they were doing was the sprint down underwater backs, which is certainly one of the most challenging drills. You got to sprint as fast. I mean, I say as fast, like in quotation, because nobody's giving their full sprint, but like as fast as you can to the other side of the pool and immediately dive the 25 meters back. And then they were only giving us 30 second rest. And I remember, and I talk about this in one of our programs, how to hold your breath like a rescue swimmer. That was the closest I came to shallow water blackout is because I was already so oxygen deprived. My heart rate was high. And so I think I had somehow purged a lot of CO2. And now I'm swimming sprint and I swim back, and I remember the lactic acid, like just not having any oxygenation in the legs anymore, and that tunnel vision coming in. I was like, yeah. Oh no, here it is, and I like barely made it to the other side, and one of the instructors caught it. It was like, you doing all right there? Because I was like really woozy and like tippy, and I was able to mitigate it by controlling my breathing. So that was that's how I prevented that. But I want to share, like, as far as like the toughest drill that I think most or a lot of rescue swimmers would agree with, that's what's called the buddy brick. And you see that in the Guardian, but they don't make it look like it's that big of a drill. It's where they're pushing those big cinder blocks at the bottom of the pool. So in that drill, you have a teammate, and the goal is to move a brick from one side of the pool to the next and back and forth, however many times they make you do that. It can vary between 50, 100. In my airman program, I think we had to do it for 200 or something. It was really long. Yeah.
You move it on the bottom of the pool.
So that's the thing. Yeah. The drill's a little complicated. So, all right, pay attention, people that are listening. So here we go. You start two people. It's a team drill. It's a team exercise. So you both go down. Both, it can only move. The brick can only move when two people's hands are on it. So Ooh. Then you go to the bottom of the pool. You can move it together only. Then you come to a stop. There needs to always be one hand on the brick. So one person needs to be on the brick while the other person can resurface, take, generally it's one breath, come back down. Meanwhile, that person's drowning. Typically the cycle goes, then you move it again as two. Then the other person comes up, takes that breath while the other person's waiting. And this is just, unless you get in a good cycle, which takes practice and it's very mentally challenging, it's a compounding cycle of you just every time you're just getting more and more oxygen deprived, and you just want this to be over as soon as possible. So that's called the buddy brick.
That is a hard one. That is definitely a hard one. I've never had to do anything similar to that. Now there's one I do like that we do here at the Naval Academy. Is you have two people and one mask, right? And you have to swim 500 yards underwater. Only one person at a time can use the mask. The other guy has to swim on top of him like a rescue buddy. And you can only advance the mask underwater. And so when you're done with it, you drop it, leave it on a buddy. Leave it on the ground. Your buddy comes down, grabs it, clears it, and starts the underwater swim. And you do that for 500 yards. So it's just like a drill. It's a drill of, I think it's a little less complicated than the two people on it at a time. That sounds awful. But it was just one of those fun little drills that we have used to help with mass clearing, underwater swimming, and just general buddy working together drills. I think yours is absolutely fantastic. It just reminded me of a little drill that we like to do as well.
That's a great drill, Stu. So the person on the surface is breathing, right?
Breathing,
so just freestyle or whatever.
Freestyle stroke. Breathing, just watching the buddy, you know, making sure, you know, he's the rescue swimmer, so to speak, and just being a buddy. And then whenever the guy's done moving, he has to take off the mask, drop it on the bottom, come up, catch his breath. And then the other guy goes down and advances the mask like that. So it's just a little drill. Yeah. Okay. So now let's talk a little bit about the job. What happened after you graduated, and where'd you go after that?
So this is the disappointing part a little bit. I remember just no rescue swimmer class that was graduating got any. So our picks, as you call them, the stations, nobody got picks on the West Coast. There was nothing that was ever coming up. So when when we were about to graduate, I was like, oh, we're so due for a West Coast pick. But sure enough, nothing came up. So the picks were like Miami. We had, North Carolina, we had Atlantic City, and we had Detroit, Michigan. And that I got like corrupted into somebody saying like that Detroit is a secret gem, and some people would certainly agree with that. I don't know about it myself still, But basically, I decided to go to Detroit, Michigan to serve on the Great Lakes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. A little freshwater.
A little freshwater, yeah.
Yeah. How was that? Because, I mean, obviously, it's cold. But coming from Canada, you're used to it. So.
Yeah. I mean, I would have picked Puerto Rico in a heartbeat. It was fine, to be honest with you. It's like, and there's some beautiful places up there, especially like the Upper Peninsula area.
Oh, absolutely.
But as far as like the Detroit region, I got to love with you. Well, not my favorite, you know, I've seen better places for sure.
Did you get stationed anywhere else?
Nope. So what's cool is like, you do a lot of different courses. So like, you know, you go to EMT school, that's in Petaluma, California. You're there for a while. You go to Advanced Helicopter Rescue Swimmer School, which Cody just redid as well, business partner there. And that's in Washington/Astoria, Oregon. And then you're working like the Big Surf there. So, and then you can deploy to like different like locations as well during that time. But overall, no, you're serving in like that station.
Gotcha. So how about this? medical qualifications of most rescue swimmers, where are they on that spectrum?
So EMTs is what we are. EMT basics. I'm actually in the process. I've upkept it. You know, I'm a veteran now, but I've kept it up since then. It renews every 2 years. I'm in a cycle of doing it again now. And so it's basically an ambulance driver. So you know, definitely more than first response, but less than a paramedic.
Now, as a rescue swimmer, are you offered advanced medical school? Like, can you take that to a paramedic level?
Some rescue swimmers have done that journey but mostly in most stations, it doesn't require it.
Right.
I believe though, potentially in Alaska, in one station, they potentially require some rescue swimmers to be EMT advanced.
Right.
So, and then I think, I forget which medicine that you can potentially provide. I think, I don't know if you can do IVs with that, but yeah, there's maybe one or two stations that require a little further than emergency medical technician qualification. What's cool though is like, you know, the military EMT, you have a little bit more capabilities than I would say civilian EMT. So like one thing we could put in is like a King Airway. I don't think civilian EMTs are technically supposed to do that. There's some cool things that you can do for sure when you're out there. Nice. out in the surf.
So were you busy out there in the Great Lakes?
That comes down to luck. So some rescue swimmers would get, I mean, I don't know what's busy. They would potentially get like a case every month or two, and that would be busy. Like if you're getting a real case, like one of my friends who we've had on the podcast as well, Nate Feske, he had a rescue over the Niagara Falls. That's like right above the Niagara Falls. That's a story and a half, right? Like he had a boat. Yeah. Like a father and a son, they had their boat. I don't know. I only a couple hundred yards, I want to say, from the top of the Niagara Falls, just there getting wrecked by the current. And I think only a couple minutes later after the hoist, that boat went over the falls. So that just goes to show it was like a ticking time bomb. And yeah, he went down and hoisted these individuals. That's a story right there, right? So there's certainly some occasional cool cases, but mostly like a lot of medevacs is what occurs in Michigan. And nevertheless, you're getting called on a lot of search and rescue cases. And one of the frustrating ones specifically in Michigan was like a red flare sighting, which could have been anything, right? That could be any, and like, and false maydays, and just a bunch of you would get launched on a lot of nonsense that was unfortunately costing a lot of gas and people's time and manpowers and keeping us up a lot, you know. So you're definitely launching and like going on a search and rescue case like damn near every shift, but as far as like doing something where you're hoisting somebody off the Niagara Falls, that depends on how lucky you are. For sure.
I gotcha. Yeah. Tell me this. What is like one of the coolest stories that of all Coast Guard rescue swimmers, like who is the Coast Guard rescue swimmer, like hero that everybody Ooh. Wants to be. And everybody wishes they had that op.
Ooh. That's that's a question I would have better answered when I was first becoming a rescue swimmer. Cause I was all up in those books, in the literature, the history of it. I knew those names of rescue swimmers that were famous. But now I can only reference people I know that I look up to. But there is one story that I've certainly heard that I always loved. And this is a case where technically a rescue swimmer is not qualified to go within an overturned vessel or an underwater vessel. That's against our operational, like we're restricted to not, we're not supposed to do that.
So a capsized vessel.
That's right.
And just going in to see if anybody's.
That's right.
In the air pocket. Got it.
Cause we're not divers, right? We can hold our breath typically for a very prolonged period of time, but that's against the regulations. So nevertheless, there was a case where there was a boat that was overturned, still, you know, afloat. And there were people in there screaming and calling for help. And this rescue swimmer deploys and he goes out there. And the scene is that there's other vessels there and they're all like yelling at the rescue swimmer, like, get in there, like, help him. And the rescue swimmer's like, damn, I'm not, I could lose my job by going into this vessel. And he made the call of, and thinking on the spot, he made the call to get the flight mechanic to drop down everyone's seize bottles. So, you know, as your flight crew, you in your vest, then this is one of the things that a rescue swimmer maintains. You have these little O2 bottles that don't hold many breaths. Honestly, most of the time when we were just testing them out and breathing in them, like deep breaths, we were just getting like a big breath, to be fair, but like 6 to 8, right?
Okay.
So anyway, this rescue swimmer calls and everyone just basically donates their seize bottle in the crew. And he decides to, strap them all together and go into this vessel using these seize bottles. And he went in there and he got to the person. Unfortunately, he got to that person and it was too late. But that was a very interesting one because this is one that commandants often, or a commandant would, actually it was just, he was just an admiral, but I don't think he was the commandant. An admiral was sharing a lot is because that rescue swimmer could never be awarded anything because of that policy. And it took like years, several years before he got commendated for that mission. And I don't know, that one just always stuck with me. I thought that was a very cool one that he thought on the spot, decided to grab some bottles and just break the policy anyway. And yeah, it was kind of a cool one because I think, yeah, normally there'd be some punitive action there, but I think overall that command saw, like, I don't know, the command made a good decision that didn't decide to like take action on that because, you know, that swimmer did his best and he put his life on the line to try to make something happen there.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, you know, when you are, raised on the motto that others may live, that is your motto too, right? A rescue swimmer's motto, or PJs use it. You know, it's just one of those things that it's your mantra, you know, and you will do anything you can to help somebody live another day. And, you know, that seems like sometimes you got to make those tough decisions. Yep. You know, you got to live with yourself at the end.
Yeah.
I'm sure he can. Yep. All right. So now let's talk about what you're doing now. One of the neat things that I've heard you say several times in this conversation is mindset. Like you've talked about your own mindset. You talked about the rescue swimmer mindset, and that is now your business. It's called the Rescue Swimmer Mindset, rescueswimmermindset.com. Obviously, understand what you're trying to do. Prepare people for rescue swimmer jobs, but you also have some really cool workouts on there that's just for anybody. Do you want to train like a rescue swimmer? Do you want to be comfortable in the water like a rescue swimmer? I love it. I love the whole thing because I have found that any of these jobs require a certain mindset, right? And you can have all the physical fitness and training you want. You can have all the discipline you want. You can have all this grit and mental toughness that you want. And then there's like this little question at the very top of that little pyramid that I'm making is like, how bad do you want it? Right. And then your mindset has to be part of that process. You have to have an answer for how bad do you want it? And it comes down to really heart and passion, you know, to be successful in these journeys. And you as a rescue, you and Cody, who were created this rescue swimmer mindset, what is the number one mission that you, what you're trying to do?
So we certainly started with focusing on the mindset that was crucial to our success in the school. And that's why Cody came up with the book, Rescue Swimmer Mindset. And that's where the our company truly started. And that's a great book, a short read, but very appreciated by the community, because there's not much literature out there as far as the mindset and just the cycle of progress that we do as rescue swimmers to achieve what we've achieved. So it certainly started with that. And then, we definitely saw the gap in the aquatic world as far as like the rescue swimmer community goes in the training of it. So basically what the rescue swimmer mindset does is, we've come up with these programs that are either educational. So we have these master classes that really break down in video, so you get a lot of visuals to learn proper technique and physical development to achieve the standards of a rescue swimmer without per se wanting to do that. Because our audience isn't always, there's a lot of civilians that want to just be fit and learn from the things that we've learned to develop themselves into athletes and train like us. Because it's a very niche way of training that not everyone is accustomed to. So, we have our programs that are just dedicated to the training. So if you're looking to train like us, then there's our programs for sure for that. But if you're trying to learn and evolve, then we have a lot of programs that are master classes, like Perfect Form, which we're breaking down visually, every micro detail of how to swim effectively as a military operator, but also whether that's in a pool or in the ocean, and whether that's as a civilian or in a military, like tactical way. So, at this point, it's really cool connecting with all our students as far as their progress and their journey, whether that be going to rescue swimmer school. We have a lot of individuals that are going through BUDS as well, and a lot of Air Force PJs actually. We've been training because a lot of those, it's kind of a.
They're all very similar.
Very similar, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think that's great. What have you found some of the difficulties in training people to swim? We have fortunately, as today's technology allows for some great streaming videos out there. But are you also able to do in-person training at all, or do you, mix it up with both?
We've done both for sure. In-person is great. And then as well as like working with people online and then communicating through COVID has certainly been like kind of our fallback. As far as, you see a lot of the common mistakes and, it comes down to drag, right? Or, just honestly, more than anything, like your hip positioning is like one of the main ones. I could break down the whole form, but there's certainly commonalities, and that's what's great as a coach of that and an instructor of that to be trained and adaptive of seeing those now earlier on and making those corrections, and learning as well, like through the students, which is depending on their needs and how they're trying to progress.
Right. Go ahead. What are the most important strokes to learn as a rescue swimmer?
Definitely freestyle is the go-to. And then for us, it comes down to buddy towing a lot, right? So that is a similar kick to your freestyle, except you're going to be doing that with your hip. And the importance of that is like keeping your hip up. So you're swimming sideways in a scissor kick and you're keeping your hip up because that your hip is behind that survivor's coccyx area and pushing his hips forward and up to plane them out. So that's certainly important. And that's a skill that you need to work on and develop. And so that's one. And then as far as like the underwaters go, that we train different techniques depending on like your abilities. I'd say overall the consensus would be that a breaststroke underwater is a good form. I mean, it's slightly modified than surface breaststroke, but that's pretty much the one. But aside from that, you know, if you don't have that flexibility in the knees, the hips, the joints area, then you can turn that into a scissor kick, which actually we've referenced people to your videos. We've sent them your way because a lot of times I've seen you're teaching people underwater with like more of a modified scissor kick. I would personally often use a scissor kick too.
Those are the main strokes. I have found this, you know, in teaching people swimming is you have people who come from a water background and have actually developed a nice frog kick or breaststroke kick. And then you have people coming from the land athletes that are, you know, used to running, right? Which you think about the muscles developed there, ideal for scissor kick, flutter kicks. And I just try to take people's strengths that when they're coming into this world, like what's their strengths going into it? Because I will tell you this, it took me a good, I probably didn't learn breaststroke kick till I was 4 or 5 years outside of the teams. I mean, like, like post buds, like I finally learned how to do a good breaststroke kick, which that in turn helped me learn how to do the egg beater. Like I never really learned the egg beater until I was already in the teams. I just scissor kicked my way through everything. Right. I mean, and it was a little bit of, muscling through the water. I think compared to some of the nice, powerful breaststroke kicks that are out there that if you were really good breaststroker, I tell people just do the breaststroke. It's going to be better than your scissor kick. Right. Yep. But if you really aren't very good at swimming, it's almost a natural transition just to go into a scissor kick.
It is.
At least that's been my experience. And then how many times have you answered the question with almost a not snarky remark, but I say this. In fact, I wrote an article on this one. It's called "Dude, You're Not in Swimming Shape." Right. It's like I can run a 6 minute mile for 10 miles. I can do this. I do this. I know I'm in great conditioning. Right. But then I try to swim and I get winded after 200 yards. I'm like, dude, you're not in swimming shape. And you probably need to learn some technique.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's for sure. But there's the other thing too. Like some people are so muscular that they sink and like therefore they do need a lot of technique.
True.
To stay afloat. And that's, yeah, I mean, that's the thing too with like swimming is like, you know, the faster you go, the more you're going to stay planked out. So, you know, like keeping that momentum and having the technique to keep your momentum is certainly important too. And that said, like, you know, fat does float, but I wouldn't, yeah, you're right. You shouldn't be fat going into like hopefully trying to succeed in these military endeavors. So yeah, it's certainly, yeah, we've seen those people that come in, but still for myself, it comes down to mostly technique is because I've seen people that don't look per se in shape, but they're phenomenal swimmers. They just nail that technique.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I would say swimming 90% technique, 10% conditioning.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. It's pretty phenomenal.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to be good. Now, if you're not very good at swimming, you're probably going to have to rely on 50% conditioning, right? Yeah. Which is hard. I mean, you just got to get in really good shape. So some of my favorite workouts I do is like, we don't really need to worry about freestyle, but I use freestyle to get people winded, right? And actually work on their conditioning, right? Because they suck at freestyle, but they're a lot better with the side stroke or maybe with the breaststroke. And then we try to catch our breath with the easier stroke, right? So eventually they kind of get into a swimming condition, you know, with an easier stroke that they've really used freestyle to kind of get their heart and lungs for that. So it's just some ideas that we've had over the years.
Yeah. Similarly, in some of our programs, we actually throw in some butterfly in there because we're trying to wreck them. Like that's the objective is, there's a lot of things you actually learn from the butterfly in doing the butterfly, whether that's you got good technique or bad technique. And that's why we instill it. But also it's in the cycle of our training programs that we want them to get extremely winded, and the butterfly is the toughest stroke. It's like, it's like a sprint, right? So regardless of how slow you're going, it's pretty much a sprint to successfully get yourself out of the water and grab that breath. So yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying for that. And yeah, it's fun. It's fun to definitely have those different types of training that you're not necessarily going to use in a military program. Or if you're training for an Ironman, but it's good in your training for sure. I'm a big proponent of sprints as well, though. Like just in general, like if you're running, I don't know, long runs, in my opinion, it does to wear and tear on your body if you're doing so much. So like sprints, though, I'm a big advocate for sprinting and whether that be in the water or not.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. How about this? Whenever you are coaching, do you have a lot of people that are struggling with treading water?
100%.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if we're talking like treading water, like in the Guardian scene. That's the stupidest scene I've ever seen in my life. As far as like, all right, you gotta survive an hour of like treading. That never happened. And
okay,
I think everyone would make that because you could just kind of float
like an hour with no hands. Or
no, that's not what they were doing in the movie. Okay. They're just like in the water for like an hour or something. And I'm
the no hand tread is the big killer. Awesome.
Yes. So if we're talking that kind of treading, the egg beater, the water polo technique, yes, that's repeatedly something we're teaching and breaking down. Cody's actually the big educator on that in our program, that Perfect Form program. Yes, that was a challenge for me. I remember struggling with it 100% in my airman program, and Cody would say the same. He like his rescue swimmers would say he was going to fail out because he couldn't do the treading, right? And that wasn't the case. That said, yeah, I remember like one of the swimmers, like a big Samoan guy, phenomenal rescue swimmer. By big, I just mean like big boned, like
they're like, so big, like, people.
Yeah, but not like a big Samoan, like big Islander, but like just everything was large. Like his feet were large. He was like, he looked like a swimmer. He was actually a jiu-jitsu, like I think world, maybe not world, but like champion. And he would just watch us struggle with one brick, a 10-pound brick, and be like, what's your problem? And like, he's getting totally impatient. And then he would grab like both of our, jump in the water, grab both of our bricks and just have a conversation about how we're not going to succeed in rescue swimmer for like minutes while he's just actively treading these two bricks. And we're just like, we don't like you. No, he was a great guy.
Yeah. Some people are just freaks, you know, freaks of nature, and you will see them in your training programs for sure.
To be fair, you had like size 14 feet too. Like, I'm just saying, like, I'm not saying that doesn't hinder him.
That definitely helps.
Yeah.
Oh man. Tell me this, how has mobility come into helping you teach people? Because I have seen personally that lack of mobility is a huge issue with people trying to learn how to swim and get into a good streamlined body position, you know, and also lack of knee mobility and hip mobility to do the egg beater, you know, all of those things come into play. Is there like a mobility focus at all on like some how you guys do training? Because like I said, it's just one of those big red flags for me when I see someone who can't put their biceps on their ears, you know, and get into that swimmer position.
Mobility is certainly something I'm consistently working on because I've developed some injuries now, like over the years, and it's tremendously important. And we include certainly like specific stretches that we implemented in our military service and after to improve that. As far as like swimming goes, yeah, I mean, like a big thing that we are always teaching is like long means strong. So like if you're able to extend this freestyle and really stretch yourself out, then you're getting the most bang for your buck and you're putting in the less strokes that you need to successfully get across the pool. And that does come with the mobility to do so. So yeah, that lat being able to expand, your shoulder being able to fully extend. And yeah, same for like, I never even thought of it like this, but potentially mobility could come in the form of, you know, more than anything, I think the biggest beginner mistake in swimming is when your hips are up, right? You got your butt out and therefore what everything else is falling apart. You're creating a hinge and mm-hmm. now your torso and your feet are dragging. Everything's falling apart. So mm-hmm. potentially, yeah, you're right. If you don't have the mobility of pressing those hips forward, which I feel like most people should have at least that mobility, they just don't know the technique of doing so. But yeah, having the mobility of pushing those hips slightly down or at minimum, like in line with your body is crucial. And something that we for sure are always like preaching to the students, but you're right. As far as like the breaststroke, that's a mobility thing. I still struggle with it. Like your knees, like your, yep. it's just, it, that's such a mobility thing as well as your ankles.
Yeah.
And same for like when you're doing a freestyle kick, like the ankle flexibility is something that is not really talked about yet. It's pretty crucial because like you are like kicking the foot and in a way where like you need that ankle flexibility. And if it's just stiff, it's kind of like you're moving these like 2x4s that are not really.
Yeah, it has to be formed. Your ankles have to be like comparable to a ballerina's point. I mean, not quite that extreme, but I know my daughter, she did 15 years of ballet and we would compare points sometimes because, you know, mine can flatten out, you know, I don't have any, it doesn't look like an ankle, right? Like, mm-hmm. like that, you know, it's, you know, completely straight. Hers, you know, takes another angle down, you know, it's so flexible, you know, she does ballet on her toes, but yeah, it's, if you need ankle mobility, go to YouTube. Type that in and you'll see some ballerinas showing you how to do some ankle mobility. It's very helpful.
And I love teaching these classes. And like, I always learn myself as I educate myself more and read more literature on it. But you know, I used to always teach that cliche of like point your toes, and there's truth in that of pointing sure. your toes. But I think the mistake comes that I've recently come to learn is if when you're pointing those toes, a lot of times you're really flexing those toes. And that's not actually something you want to do because that causes your calf cramping. That's yep. like, that's something that if you're flexing your toes, you're not actually being loose. You're not even propelling as efficiently as you could because like actually having the toes loose, yet your foot pointed, like you were mentioning, yep. is important. And it propels you actually in a more efficient way while also relaxing your calf muscle. So, you know, it's all these like micro adjustments that I love to learn and develop. And yeah, sure, we share in our programs. But yeah, just like, you know, toe technique is not something you would yeah. really think about, you know?
You wouldn't think about it. Yeah. So rescueswimmermindset.com is where people can find you. Last question for you. You know, what's next? Where do you see Rescue Swimmer Mindset or other things happening? What's next for you, you think?
So what I love in the Rescue Swimmer Mindset, like I'm kind of really focusing on the media aspect of it. So I'm definitely the person that's into creating a lot of the videos and that kind of content that we create. And that's because I have a passion in the film industry. So that's nice. Also how I supplement like my income is by doing film works on like larger productions and as well as like with smaller clients. So I do a lot of that. And that's like my company for that is Wildertainment. And I have a podcast as well for that and like create content. As far as the Rescue Swimmer Mindset goes, Yeah, we're very excited actually about expanding, because we've dug our like we've really dug ourselves deep into the rescue swimmer approach of how to succeed as a rescue swimmer or in an elite military position. And now we're really trying to share our knowledge with people that are just excited about training similar to rescue swimmers. So we're coming out with programs that are really more for conditioning in a specific
Nice.
way that's kind of like a rescue swimmer, but also just curtailed to like a wider audience, which is very exciting because, yeah, I think at this point, a lot of the rescue swimmer community know about us. So, and we've covered a lot of that content. So exploring a little bit of what other individuals are what their needs are is definitely exciting for the rescue swimmer mindset.
Absolutely. Being flexible and able to take your products and services to bigger markets is obviously a wise business choice. Finding, the master swimmers who are kind of bored with just looking at a black line and swimming laps for practice, can actually do something else a little more geared toward what you're teaching. Mixing push-ups on the pool deck, for one, and flutter kicks and things like that. So, yeah, I love it. I think that's a great idea. And one thing's for sure with your video background is you're obviously going to be in tune with all of the technology advancements that occur at light speed, it seems. Because when I started this, I was making VHS tapes, right? And that turned into DVDs, and now it turns into everybody's got a podcast because you can put a side-by-side streaming video and have a great conversation because of Zoom. And there's just so many more, and social media and StreamYard and so many other advancements that just really make this easy. But if you're not staying on top of it, you're going to quit growing. And I think I read on your website that if you're not growing, you're dying. Did I see that or something like that? Yeah.
It's on our first page, something to that effect.
Yeah. Yeah. So seems like you got the great mindset for moving forward. Don't let the grass grow under you. That's for sure.
I got a shoot coming up right after this, with a 12K capable camera. If anybody understands that,
I
I mean,
don't.
like that's like 4K times, what is that, times three. But like what is that is these like little pixels, so you can zoom in. So like what's really cool is like you could be really far away and your framing is like, say right now, Stu, we got like a what's called like a close-up on you.
Right.
It's not an extreme close-up, which is like Clint Eastwood eyes, but it's close up. So but we could probably shoot that close up from way far away and just punch in digitally, like in post, right? With these like
So
12K
crazy.
cameras. It's pretty funny. It's like hard to keep the focus on, because like
Yeah.
if
What's the
you're
pixel on that? I
so what it is, it's like a 4K camera's 3800 something, 40 something pixels per
per
something.
inch
Yeah,
per.
so that's whatever that is times
Wow.
three. So I don't know, like in the
Damn.
nines and yeah,
Man,
9000.
that's
Yeah,
some serious
you don't need it. You
pixels per
nobody would
inch.
watch that. Yeah, you don't even watch on your TV, so it's like stupid anyway.
I
But it's fun to play with in post.
can't imagine the file size of that.
Yeah,
I remember
that's
when
what
I
I was
first
saying.
started, everybody was using dial up, when I first started. So you couldn't have streaming videos. And if you had one video on your website, it would slow it down for, especially if you had 10 people watching it. Right.
That's right.
It's crazy what you can do now. So, yeah, man, stay relevant, keep
Absolutely,
growing.
Stu.
That's the goal. So, any last words from you, Vince?
Honestly, last words are thank you, Stu, for basically a lot of our development, and we always looked up to you. We shared on our podcast when we had you on that that we always looked up into you and your programs, and honestly, like this is the intro to our podcast with you, is how out of control your program was. And I remember your standards. I was like, this is totally unrealistic. This guy's out of his Yonkers mind. Like, there's no way this is what the requirements are. But it's setting those high standards that I did strive for to try to meet. And that honestly made those elite programs and those challenging parts of life quite a bit easier. 'Cause yeah, I just overshot it. And that's what I was saying with these rescue swimmers. I think they overshot my training. So everything after, and like what most people would think is like the very challenging things, I was always waiting for a little bit more because I had overshot it. So yeah, maybe, yeah. Shoot. Like I love your quote of, aim to win, not to survive. So that's what I'll leave it off with.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Yeah. Well, thank you for what you have done and how you've served this country, and how you're continuing to serve the next generation.
Yep.
To move forward, and hopefully those guys will be serving as well. So, hey, once again, hey, thank you for joining us. Everybody, go check out Rescue Swimmer Mindset, and you will see Vince and Cody there showing you some really cool ways to get things done. All right.
Hell yeah.
Until next time, my friend, we'll see you later.
Thanks, dude.
Good.